What's up? It's Jenny LSQ. Thanks so much for pressing play on episode 44 of the LSQ podcast. And those letters are just the phonetic approximation of my last name, nothing too fancy. You can also find me on Twitter and Instagram at Jenny LSQ. And I'm so excited to share with you a conversation with an artist I admire greatly, Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards. We met up here in LA at the end of January, so pre-quarantine, when Tune Yards were here playing a one-off show. But as you'll hear Merrill mention, there is some new Tune Yards music coming together that might even arrive later this year. So we'll talk about that and much more. Let's go.
Back one, check two. I am talking.
I was up really late with those singers, hilarious singers last night.
So what was the sort of occasion for coming in to do this kind of one-off show?
The occasion was...
It's just showtime?
It's just a show, you know, a gig.
Yeah. Where am I finding you in terms of, like, I hate to put it in the terminology of album cycle shit, but, like...
Yeah.
What have you been working on lately, and where are you in sort of Tune Yards?
That's a good question. In the cycle, it feels like the end of the world cycle, so it doesn't... Yeah. I'm like, what the hell are we doing cycling like this when there's warm water under the largest glacier in Antarctica? Or what, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, what are we doing? But to answer your question... we are right, you know, we're about to finish recording another album, so we're in the you know, almost mixing phase, which means
cool.
But it's, you know, it's January. Oh my God, it's February. Happy February.
Happy February.
It's February of the year 2020 in the United States. So, like, who wants to release a record in, you know, October of?
Oh God, good point.
You know what I mean? And at the same time, people need music and stuff, maybe. Do they? And we need some relief from everything else, but I don't know. So so in my mind, what was cool about last night was that it made no sense. That was probably the most work I've ever put into one single show in terms of 11-piece choir, two other singers on stage with us, flag, silk wavers, an intense, you know, lighting package. Anyway, it was really fun, but it had nothing. It was more just for the experiment. Oh, and we, like, audience interaction stuff, which I really had been wanting to try. But it didn't make any, it wasn't like, and this is our show that we'll be touring, and so everyone can, you know, it was just
right.
Like, no, it's tonight. And also just to see why, I mean, I want to know what the power of live performance and of music is in general right now. Like, what are the parameters? What are the, how far can we, I mean, really my question was, how do we, can releasing an album be part of building movement?
Mm-hmm.
That's really my question.
What was the audience interaction component?
When the audience entered the lobby, there were tables, and they were asked to answer questions that we had on cards. And so the questions were, describe a profound experience you have had with plants. One was, describe a profound experience you've had with art. And then there were two transforming questions. How are you transforming, and how are you transforming the world? Seems really hokey when I say it like that. But it was really interesting the array, you know, the spectrum of the answers that we got. And then the idea was I would get those cards before our set, which I did, and then sort through a bunch. Jason and Laura helped me sort through, and then I read them, like, in an improvised way on stage, just kind of choosing timing for things. And then the other part of the audience interaction was just singing. Like, they were asked to sing and they did sing in three-part harmony, which is something that I wasn't sure could happen. So just these ways of trying to get away from, you're there sitting, watching a show and just kind of like being entertained versus we're doing something here together, which, you know, Tune Yards shows I've always tried to do that, but maybe it's becoming more important to me now. to understand like what's the use of a show. It's like that book, Michael Azarad's book, Our Band Could Be Your Life. Mm-hmm. How a culture, like how does a band develop a culture that's not just compelling to fans, but that provides, my friend Jess George, I think she called it like my political home. Like that I think, I know I am searching for, I'm searching a lot these days. Like who has an answer that seems compelling? Mm-hmm. And I don't claim to have any answers, but like what if we could provide some kind of home for people to gather with each other and kind of say, well, we're all here, you know, for a lot of different reasons, but we're finding that this music or this band's culture is compelling enough to bring us here,
right.
And that provides some kind of unifying force.
And do you, I mean, have you had that relationship with artists that you're a fan of? You know, are there artists that you can think of who are that for you or have been that when you were a kid? Or
that's a really good question. Yeah, I mean, I feel like Ani DiFranco, you know, when I was in high school, that was like the first woman with a shaved head I ever saw, probably, and the first woman talking about having relationships with other women, and the first woman, frankly, talking about being how fucked it is to be a woman in the world. And I hadn't, because she was saying those things, then when we would go to shows, you'd be like, oh, it's a bunch of like queer women with shaved heads, you know, like it was just like a joyful party of feeling safe, really.
Mm-hmm.
And feeling at home. And I think what the mistake, if there's a mistake of the 90s, I'm sure there's plenty of mistakes in the,
oh boy.
of the 90s, but that we put that on one person instead of seeing that the culture that's being built is the people who are going to the shows. It's
yeah.
not just this one person, magnificent as she is. And it's, you know, that's, and same with, you know, think of Lauryn Hill, think of all these, particularly women that get, you know, we put so much on them that they have to know it all instead of,
right.
Well, what if it's actually what's being created at the shows and what's being created by,
and it's interesting because Ani obviously started her own label. She's like in a category mm-hmm. unto herself, mm-hmm. and I'm sure in her memoir she writes about this. I haven't read it yet, but you know, I'm imagining that was in part a decision because she, you know, got rejected by labels, or there wasn't the sense that it would be a successful bid.
Mm-mm.
You know, I think one of the big mistakes of the 90s / music industry in general is not recognizing people like that and instead trying to make everyone pass as the same,
yep.
You know?
Totally.
And you think about an example from the 90s like Fiona Apple, mm-hmm. who, because she was so young and signed to a major label right out of the gate, you know, they did everything they could to present her as this certain kind of, like,
yeah.
you know, barely legal whatever. And in reality, we know it was pretty quickly, you know, there's no reining in that spirit,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
she made it clear who she really is, and it's
yeah.
like, and then you can, but I think, you know, when you get, the industry gets involved, they, like, try and make everything the same instead
yep.
of letting it be different, and the difference is what I think maybe draws in the kind of community you're talking about, where they're
totally.
Like, this is my
right.
artist or whatever.
Right, and I think, I mean, as another example, a band like Phish, for instance, where they have their own thing going on.
Yeah.
They rely on their own fans. My Morning Jacket, I would say, is another band where the fans, you know, knowing a little bit about how their fans like organize with each other to do charitable work, to do philanthropic work.
Wow,
that
cool.
is that it's not the band telling them what to do. This is what I'm hearing that, you know, secondhand kind of, but mm-hmm. like that's my understanding is that bands and I would say both of those bands maybe struggle to win that mainstream industry
mm-hmm.
whatever that is.
Acknowledgement. Acknowledgement.
Right. I mean, now Fish, I think, is like, you know, Rolling Stone will like, you know, holds them up as rock gods now. But like for decades, they were like that weird band, that weird jam band.
Yeah.
But I think completely that and maybe it's not just the music industry, but maybe that's probably that is capitalism. That capitalism is the thing that says, okay, wait, we have a marketable thing. We have a safe bet. So now let's make everybody that because we know that's what sells versus like the humanity of musicians, you know, who are totally different and who come to music, you know, for very different reasons.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's fucked. Basically, it's fucked.
Yeah.
When you started playing music and doing it as a thing that you were going to focus efforts on to the exclusion of other stuff you might do with your time, did you have any sense then that music would be something that would become this much of your world or that it would... Were you always drawn to it in a way that felt like this is the most important thing for me?
I think, yeah, even when... I think for a really long time, because my parents are both musicians, my mom professionally and my dad, I mean, I guess I would say semi-professionally at certain points, but they... That was what they did, and so I chose theater as the thing that I did. And I think for a long time, I rejected music as a career because I didn't want to teach like my mom does, and I didn't, you know, it just they played folk music with their friends, and had that a rich community of that. But it's like, are you going to make money playing fiddle tunes on, you know, very few people make money. Right. You know, I didn't see that as a career. Somehow I thought theater was going to be the thing, you know, but, and not just theater, but like weird ensemble based theater in Vermont, you know, I was like, that's where, you know, that's where I'm going to make my mark. But I think I just, until I was so depressed and in my early 20s and just couldn't fathom doing anything else except for the one thing that made me happy, which was music. I don't think I ever would have been like, music's going to be my life and I'm going to have a successful band and make a living this way. It was literally just because it was the only thing that made me want to still be on the planet. And so that it wasn't like an option. It wasn't like a career choice. It was just like, this is the thing I can do. And I never would have imagined that this would be my life. That we'd be in some fancy hotel, you know, you asking me questions like I'm an important person, you know, like that did not, I was like, if I can not be living in my car and, you know, be playing the ukulele, that'd be awesome.
Yeah. What were the earliest, like, music things that you were drawn to? What was the first music you loved?
Like, earlier?
Early. It gave you a special feeling.
Well, my mom played a lot of Bach when I was probably in utero.
Right.
So I think there's always, and you know, my dad was playing, I don't know, Ricky Skaggs, Steely Dan, lots of bluegrass, lots of great music. The Beatles. I mean, of course we had a lot of, especially early Beatles when I was a kid. The blue and red compilations. Oh, yeah. Those are my favorites as a kid. But we had everything. And also I grew up going to early music camp with my mom. She plays the harpsichord. And so in terms of like early, the kind of musical moments where you're tingling all over and you just kind of want like a, you know, maybe... what we would now call ASMR experiences with music. A lot of those were in the woods of Massachusetts, listening to like recorder ensembles and viola da gamba ensembles. So I was exposed to a lot that other people are not really young. And also not just recorded music, but a lot of live music around all the time. A lot of you know, folk instruments and gatherings that way.
What were the first things that felt like your music that you were like had to chase them?
Michael Jackson. I mean, in terms of like when I was like, oh, this is my music, not my parents' music. Yeah. It was like listening to when we moved to Connecticut I finally had my own radio, mm-hmm. and my own little attic space where I would hide. It was all the stuff that was on New York radio in the late 80s.
Right.
Like all, you know,
yeah, well, I know.
Drum machines we'd never heard before. You know, just these like really, and my parents, I think that was where I was like, oh, I am a child of the 80s, you know. my parents had no...
that's too around when they launched, I remember too, when they launched Z100.
I was going to say.
That was major.
Z100.
Z100 was major.
Huge.
Because I don't remember life before Z100, but I remember when it started, it was just like, whoa, this is for the kids.
Because where did you grow up?
In Queens, New York, okay. Yeah. So how did, going back to Baby Merrill, how did you go from listening to Z100 to listening to Ani DiFranco?
Shoot, do I remember?
And did you have a friend or someone who kind of told you about a world of music outside of that?
Yeah, yes, absolutely. I had my folk music friends. I was working at that same camp that I went to as a child. I started volunteering there when I was probably 15, 16. And we would go to like folk festivals during the year together, then like NEFA, the New England Folk blah 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 mm-hmm. Alliance, and we would go and wear, you know, flowy 90s skirts and and do contra dancing, and that was a world in which because it again at that time, like you're saying, there was how did you discover music, and a lot of it, most of it was just your friends being like, have you heard this, buying you a CD. So especially with Ani DiFranco, and I think I did read her memoir, and she's talking about how, I mean, yeah, it was just you know, friends telling friends, because she didn't have major label distribution, so she was selling a lot of albums just by word of mouth. That's how different it was, really.
Yeah.
Because it was notable enough to be like, have you heard, you know,
yeah.
have you heard this music?
I know, it is funny that, like, you know, when my memories sometimes involve the internet when the internet didn't exist, but you think about
yeah.
an artist like that and how, I mean, even more recently, like, not that long ago, the band Clap Your Hands Say Yeah, mm-hmm. their first album was not on a label, and they managed to sell like 60,000 copies of
wow.
it. Now, there's internet then, but it wasn't real, and they were well received, but it wasn't,
yeah.
you know, it wasn't the kind of e-commerce you can imagine now. Just have them
wow.
mailing CDs to record stores around the country to the tune of 60,000 of those.
That's crazy.
It's crazy.
That's,
but it's a good reminder that, like, that's what virality is too,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
It's like,
right.
it's not just like accepting what's been positioned to be viral, and so you have no choice because you're like, well, this is the thing, I guess everyone's sharing this, you know?
Yeah. Which actually, I mean, I don't know, you, how long have you been out here in LA?
I just do winters here, actually. I'm a snowbird.
Ah, I wonder. Good for you.
Yeah. So you've caught me here in the winter a couple
cool.
of times. Yeah.
That seems like a great survival mechanism.
It's a system.
Yeah. Because I don't know. This place scares me. And I think I think part of it is because of that seeking virality, good word, but in it, like an empty shell way.
Mm.
Seeking it for its own sake. I mean, for the sake
yeah.
of let's crack the system and figure out how to make everybody, you know, really love this song that's actually terrible.
Right.
Like that happens a lot. I mean, and I don't know. I have my own taste, so maybe I just think certain things are terrible. But I don't understand a lot of what, like, does it even matter if something is so popular? If it's empty, because I guess that's back to our band could be your life. You know, as do I run out and buy the next Anita Franco album these days? No. And I love her, but I don't, but I have to admit that I don't do that. However, I am a long-term fan. Well, I will go back, you know, I'll go be like, what's Ani doing these days? You know, there is something, she's in my musical blood for sure. Like she's, someone that I will go back to versus something that was put there for me. I'm trying to think of like a Candy song. Do you watch that show Songland ever?
I don't.
It's a unusual songwriting TV show.
What? Sounds cool.
It does. It is. And it's very like LA songwriting.
Okay.
Forgetting his name. Ryan Tedder.
Okay.
It's like Ryan Tedder show, basically.
And they do groups and they have to write songs on certain topics or something. Or
Songwriters come in, they present a song to an artist. So like the Jonas Brothers are the guests. Jersey.
Love the Joe
Brothers. Great guys. They're like, do you really know them?
I do. I spent some time with them.
Really?
I was with them when Michael Jackson died. It was crazy.
Whoa. Yeah. They seem actually like really nice
so sweet,
people.
Yeah.
And they're really from Jersey, right?
They are, yeah.
Okay, cool. I was talking to Tony Tone, who did Silks for our show last night. Tony Tone Nicolka. She's from Jersey. I was born in Jersey. Anyway, and sometimes it's like the Jersey shame comes on, and then I'm like, wait a second. But Jonas Brothers are like, we're looking for a new song for our album, and these three, you know, newbie songwriters come out and perform their songs that they're a song that they wrote, and trying to sell it to the Jonas Brothers actually, and Will I Am was one of the artists, I can't even give this away to you. You have to watch this. You have to watch that episode. Promise me.
I will.
However you feel.
For listeners, I'm doing sort of a nose pinch, forehead press of cringy, but also must see this immediately.
Whatever feelings are coming up for
you. You had me at Will I Am. You had me at Will I Am.
But it was amazing to see, because I'm just, I want to see behind the scenes. You listen to the radio and there's all this stuff, but like someone, as generic as stuff might seem on the radio, there are human beings working really, really hard to make pop songs. And you see that in this show. And there is, of course, a playlist from the show. You know, those songs are streaming. They're like, and now at the end of the show, you're like, and you can hear the single, blah, 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 right? It's all part of the whole marketing scheme. And one of those Will.i.am songs, at the time, I was like, this is, I'm going to listen to this song 18,000 times in a row. And I did. And then I never wanted to hear it ever again. You know, that to me is that different thing than going deep with an artist. And really, we all have that, right? Like, you would not be doing what you're doing, I presume, if you didn't have deep, profound moments with music, right?
Oh, yeah. But also, I find that I have that kind of thing sometimes too, where I go back to a record I listened to 18,000 times in 1996 or something, and it doesn't do it, and I can't really listen, even, you know, where I'm just like, wow, this really hit me at that time. I mean, then other things that I still, you know, some of my most listened to albums are things I still listen to once a week, like almost, almost weekly, or at least
what?
I mean, like, I really love the Postal Service album. Yeah. I listen to it all the time.
Yeah.
It's just like, if I'm not sure what I want to listen to, I might put that on because it still always works for me.
Yeah.
You know? Or even, like, I know Morrissey is deservingly canceled, but I still will listen to the Smiths and just be like, I just can always listen to it.
Yeah.
Or Dylan. Or, you know, certain things.
Yeah.
But there are so many that I've gone back to because I do a show that's like old school indie show. And I'm like, ooh, I'm going to find that one whatever song. It's not that it's not still great, but it just does. I'm just like, oh, I really remember having a much more.
Yeah.
Or I listen to the album. I can't. I'm like, what was that one song?
Right.
What was it? I think it was this. And then I think of me crying next to my 5-CD changer. I'm like, remember for her what
exactly.
that song was.
What was it? What meant so much? There is. Yeah. Yeah. Which I think is different. I think those, to me, I'm trying to think of for me. Well, like we played last night with Mia Farka Touré, Ali Farka Touré's son. And I guess probably because I come from parents who are deservedly music snobs. You know, they know good music and they're really harsh critics.
Yeah.
That I know what a deep, like, I will always go back to Ali Farka Touré's music. That's deep, great music.
Right.
And musicianship, you know, it's about musicianship, I think, at a certain point, which is different than some of the stuff we're talking here, which is kind of like the cultural impact maybe of music or...
Well, it's the magic. You know, sometimes there's magic and you're like, I don't know why I fucking... like this song, it's not like anything I like, but I've got a, it's a banger or whatever the parlance of our times.
Right.
Versus things where you're just like, yeah, this is a masterwork. Yeah. It's just is.
It just is, yeah. And I'm finding those are, I mean, for me, it's like Johnny Clegg, South African musician, RIP. And there's a specific, like that, it's just that album that I will go back to forevermore. And it has cheesy 80 synths on it, you know, like to no one else might understand why I like that album, but to me it's really deep musicality wise, meaning, you know, like Dylan, I have a specific relationship with Bob Dylan. I have a specific
relationship. Very but, precise. He doesn't know about it
exactly. Yeah, he's never met me, doesn't know my name, but the poetry, right? I mean, it's deep enough so that you can keep finding newness in it. And that also, like, that's the kind of music I want to be making. I know what I'm saying about Ani DeFranco is probably what people are going to be saying about me or already are. Like, oh, in 2011, yeah, I was really into Tune Yards and we wore face paint to shows. Wow. I haven't heard, like, are they still a band? You know, like that, it's always going to happen that way. I understand that. But if I can be still making music that I believe in enough to think that it's going to be worthwhile listening in decades to come, like that's all I can ask for. I don't think I can ask for a career that spans these different, like, what's in vogue at the time, you know?
Right.
I can't be popular over a year or two, let alone over decades. You know what I mean?
So what this moment that you describe where you're, you know, in your early 20s and you sort of realize that, like, playing music is the only thing that keeps you wanting to be alive, what did you decide to do with that? I mean, if that was a moment when you kind of had a realization, what was that when you decided to, I've got to do something with this? How did it evolve into actually becoming a person who does music full time?
I mean, the short story is I was a puppeteer. That was my gig. And I, as a puppeteer, developed a solo puppet opera.
Oh, wow.
And I wrote friends of mine suggested that I use a soprano ukulele because my friend Circa said she said, it sounds really creepy. And I had never thought of ukulele that way. That of the ability to have it sound creepy. And the puppet opera was about a mother selling her kid to the butcher for money.
Wow, a puppera.
Oh yeah, exactly, puppera. and so the music needed to be creepy. And anyway, so I decided that I liked the writing of the songs better than I, you know, more than the puppet part. And then that summer, there was a summer where I quit my puppeteering job and I went to work at Apple Farm, a music camp in New Jersey.
Wonderful.
And that's where I met Nate Brenner, my now partner and in music and life, and met my friend Patrick Gregoire and Suvi, who became what do you call that when you name something after a person?
The namesake, yeah.
Yeah, so Patrick and I eventually, we started playing music together at the end of that summer, and I was like, oh, how about having a band with this wonderful person? and these wonderful people, and we started Sister Suvi, and that was, and then I started going back and forth to Montreal, and Patrick was the person who said, because it was the time at that point, the mid-2000s, Arcade Fire, Wolf Parade, it was like Canada, you know, between Montreal and Toronto,
yeah,
Canada was like its own LA yeah. of music industry success stories, and Patrick was the one who was like, no, this is actually a viable option to make a living. And I was like, you kidding me? No way.
Right.
But we just, you know, that was how I got John into trying to make a living doing it. I was otherwise just trying to do it as much as possible and write songs and express myself.
Once you kind of made that decision, though, that you know, sort of realizing like, no, this doing this makes me feel better. I need to do more of this, and then you started doing more of it. Did you start to feel better?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, because there's nothing like screaming your guts out on stage to just like let it all out.
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing that compares.
I mean, it must have been an exciting kind of, must have been exciting to kind of shift from feeling that sort of like, oh, it's what else is there, to being like, no, there's something. It's this thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it literally became my reason for living. And now I understand, too, that in order to drive a band to a place where you are touring, recording, writing songs, I mean, it's like 8 jobs in one. We were booking, you know, we were driving ourselves. We were doing everything in that DIY band fashion. And so it's all consuming. We didn't do anything but that for 4 years, basically. And then I added Toon Yards on top of that when Sister Suvi became, it wasn't the outlet that I wanted for all of my songs. And so I started the Looping Pedal solo gig thing at around that same time. And so I was just writing songs all the time. I was like living off popcorn, you know, I was just doing the thing. I would get like massively ill once a year or twice a year from just like overworking in that it and over touring and not eating properly and not sleeping properly. But that's, you know, I was doing that all the time. And so it's almost as if there's not as much time to be depressed.
Right.
And also I got, you know, I am a sugar addict. I got off of that a bit. I got to a place where I was just in very, very bad health, poor health in my early 20s too. And I think that, again, the act of just like getting up on stage, you know, night after night and not being alone at home with, because what it used to be was like house sitting gigs and just like eating, you know, these people out of house and home
right.
alone. So all of a sudden at night, instead of being alone, eating myself to death, I was out with people and out in exciting with people who are really excited to be alive, and that totally saved my life for sure.
And the earliest songs that you wrote, do you think there are elements of that in what you still do, or could you kind of recognize some of your songwriting instincts from your earliest attempts?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think I notice now that there are those theatrical moments in a lot of what are now Toon Yard songs, but kind of constructing. How do I say that? Constructing surprise moments and just moments in general that instead of conceiving of, you know, verse, chorus, bridge, chorus, or whatever, that my puppet mentors at Sandglass Theater, they would talk about creating a world, and that's a different way. Like, what you're doing is creating a world for the puppet. You're building so that the audience believes in the puppet. You don't try to make the puppet do stuff. You allow the puppet to experience the world around it. And I totally do that with song. I mean, that's my, yeah, I feel like that's what songwriting is to me, is building a sonic world building, a world that might not make sense in a linear fashion, in a narrative fashion lyrically, but that somehow it's building out a landscape of sorts that the listener gets to live in for a while. And I think that I just noted, it was the song Hatari. Hatari was kind of, that was the first song where I was like, oh, this is what I want to do with my life. I don't want to be a pop band. I don't want to be any other kind of band. I don't want to like teach music or learn music in this way. I want to do whatever this song is doing. This encapsulates how I feel about the world. And I didn't understand it necessarily, but the part in the song, in that song where it stops and then it goes, there is a natural sound that wild things make when... I can't remember it. Oh my god. And you know when you get like a blind spot in your brain, you're like, that's not coming back.
No, it's not coming back. It's all right.
It rumbles in the ground, gara, gara, we all fall down. Oh, gee. Like, whatever. Yeah. Anyway, that, whatever I wrote there was exactly what I meant. And the fact that the song stopped. The fact that it went out of time, the fact that it was kind of like a spoken word thing in the middle of it, and the fact that everything was also wrong about the song. Like, it evoked the feeling of being a white woman in Kenya. Like, that's what I wanted from it. It just felt off and weird and wrong. And it just felt like, okay, this is what I'm doing. And I would say that is what I have done. We've basically been rewriting that song for the, you know, past 11 years or whatever it's been.
Well, you've been identifying aspects of the thing that are also important to you, because once you hit on the, like, oh, I need to do this for survival, and then I want to create an environment for the puppets, and then, okay, this song is an example of how I do what I do, and you know, adding other levels of ambition to what it is, and having it be more reflective of a larger human experience than just your experience. Right. I know, you know, we had a conversation remotely for the radio one time after you had gone and done that, the course that you took leading up to the last Toon Yards album, which, you know, is an experience of trying to just expand, right, and make it something more than what it was, and more inclusive, more... So it seems like that's a thing you've sort of, every so often you set another goal for what the music can be. And as you said at the outset of this conversation, now it's interesting that you mentioned creating a world for the puppets, but we started with talking about making your band into a world for the fans. You know, they're the puppets who are moving around in the world of your music. How do you...
Wrapping it up. Bringing it back around.
Bringing it back around. Nice. Call back. you know, because I know there's going to be... You've said that there's an... I don't want to make you talk too much about an album that is many months down the line. But I am curious a little bit about how did you tackle, or what are some of the ways that that you intend to do that, to make the music more of a world for people to feel they can live in, and this challenge of writing about anything that people will hear in 2020.
Those are all good questions. Well, and you know what, I have to just confess that I have a vulnerability hangover mornings after I've done a show. And so like, right before we met, I was like, shit. Because this is the hardest time for me usually. It's the morning after a show where I lose all faith in anything I've ever done. Like, and I felt great about the show last night, but it doesn't, it's like, it's just the fact that I rip myself open that much, as cheesy as that sounds. The next morning, I mean, a friend of mine gave me that term vulnerability hangover. Like, it's too much, and so I'm in like shame mode. So when you ask that question, I'm like, well, I don't know, and I just better crawl in a hole because because I don't know what I'm doing. What we did last night and what I wanted to build with the new songs were songs. I've been asking myself the question, what songs are needed right now? What songs do people need? What words do they need? And for there, what's brewing in my head is, you know, do we source lyrics from people when they say, these are the lyrics that I need? Do we create music that is that has simple enough harmony in it that people can learn songs and learn harmonies and sing together in an audience in harmony? That these are the things that I'm mulling over. And I think what I've come to in a lot of these ways is that I need to trust myself, actually. vulnerability hangover or no, that people are already finding meaning in the music that we make. So that if I trust myself and I trust my own sense of what I want from lyrics and what I want from music, that they're going to be, that's really the only way I can do it. The other way is what lyrics do you all want to hear? And people, you know, will generally be like, I need to hear, you know, there's a light at the end of the tunnel, or hope is still alive, or these things that I personally feel no emotional attachment to. You can't tell me, like, don't tell me hope is alive in a song right now.
Ugh. Right.
We don't know what hope means anymore. Yeah. I don't. And so I need you to complicate the word hope, you know? So.
But that's what they want you to do.
Exactly.
And they're gonna find that in some obtuse thing that they think means that, or hope means that.
Exactly.
Or will tell themselves that's what you're on about, because that's the magic of songs, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's what I, after coming around and really wanting to know, for instance, like what songs do we need in direct action spaces when people are shutting down gas stations and freeways? What's needed there? Mm-hmm. And I think that brings up this whole other question of music that's used in political action, and where that, you know, so much of the music that people want to sing or do sing at rallies, at protests, at marches, is civil rights music. And so, and that's becoming problematic when a bunch of mostly white, you know, baby boomer climate activists sing civil rights songs at a climate rally. That there's also a disconnect there. And I started to get into what is protest music. And you know, I think, again, going back to Dylan, that those Dylan songs, they don't, you know, they're not straightforward. They're ever. And in fact, to such a degree that it's like Dylan against the world. You know, anytime you think you know what he's saying, he's like, no, 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 you know. So, but this is all to say, I've been thinking about, like, you know, going through all these permutations and always asking myself, what's my purpose here? And is my purpose to be in a freaking album cycle? Like, is that just the hamster wheel of musician life? Or am I meant to do this other thing? And what I keep coming back to is, like, why don't you just keep doing this thing, even though it's sometimes feels very counterintuitive to double down on my own creative integrity just like keep going and, you know, digging that rut. But that's what I keep coming back to is that we need more complication. I'll speak for myself. I don't need hackneyed messages of old style hope that doesn't feel relevant for now. And so then it becomes questions like, okay, what about this? How do we talk about, how do we keep it complicated so that I understand that what feels so urgent to me, what feels like the end of the world to me, is not necessarily the end of the world to others, mm-hmm. or that others have endured their own apocalypses mm-hmm. already. And that for me as a relatively privileged white woman to say, it's the apocalypse, is how is that erasing others' experiences of apocalypse? That we're not, as much as I think a lot of white liberals want to say, let's all get together, we're all in the same boat now, and it's sinking in the rising tides of climate change, that we are not in the same boat, and that how do we get right with each other to become a unifying force, you know, unified enough to really be able to combat true powers of evil.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think, you know, ideas like, yeah, making the harmonies things that audiences can sing together for people who've never had the physical experience of what it feels like in a room for that to happen.
Right.
I mean,
powerful,
seems like
right?
some, seems like, you know, there's no missing the message of that when it's happening.
What I feel like I really do walk, and I'm sure people can't stand the cheesiness of Toon Yard sometimes, or my utter sincerity or whatever it is, but I walk this line of because I can't help but be sincere, and I can't help but be myself, and I grew up in harmony singing. I grew up with a bunch of folkies around all the time, and the sense that collective music making was, you didn't think twice about it. Like, that was just part of life. And when we were teenagers, we'd roll our eyes, you know, and be like, you know, mom and dad are having another, you know, like, here come the banjos, or whatever. But I took it for granted that that was just happening all the time. But now it's interesting now that we are, I think, grappling in culture with how we get out of cell phone isolation and a growing sense of loneliness, however we're connected digitally, that people are going back to these, you know, to building community and song circles and these things that have been a part of me. I feel so lucky that they were always a part of me. And now I feel like there is this cultural hunger for moments of connection that are visceral. And so like something like singing in harmony, unfortunately, but like for me, that has been lost in everyday life for me. And I'm a musician, so that's saying a lot. There's a lot of, you know, again, I'm hesitating on we because, you know, if you grow up in church culture, lots, you know, you probably have a lot of communal singing all the time. Many of us don't. And so how do we bring back those things that, as cheesy it is as it is to say, I just want everyone to sing in three-part harmony, man, and then we'll all be fine. But there is truth to that being connective tissue for us as human beings.
It must feel good, though, just to be at a point where, like, you know, as an artist making unconventional music, to just have reached a level where you're like, you know what, we have this audience, we're doing the thing, we're going to put out another record, it's going to all happen, it's... You know, album campaign.
I'm glad you're saying that. I'm like, all right, if Jenny says it's going to happen, it's going to, right? It means it's going
to
happen.
But I mean, you have this opportunity to sort of give, to make it whatever you want. And because there's already people who love it and will be receptive to whatever you're going to do.
And there's already people who hate it, which is really what I needed. Like, I mean, really what I needed as a total deep people pleaser. Like me, please like me. That was always in me at war with the part of me that was like, I'm gonna get you. Like, I'm gonna tear your face off with my voice. So I always had these two things going. And now that I have experienced people truly disliking my music, our, and I'm saying our because Nate is surely part of that dissonance that we create. But now that I have experienced that and I can go, oh, it's not for everybody and that's okay. And yes, we have enough people who are getting something from this that it looks like we can continue this as a career. It's totally huge. As much as my suspicious, superstitious brain says, you know, this is all going to end really soon. And boy, have you been lucky, but your luck's about to run out. That's always kind of milling in the back of my mind. But it's true. We have so much support and we have so much, speaking of hope, I have hope that there's enough there to support whatever comes next and that people will come on the ride with us, which is no small thing.
Word. I think that's a good place to end.
Woo-hoo!
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for making so many changes and plans, but we did it.
Oh yes, that was one of my favorite interviews on the program so far, and we're almost 50 episodes in. Love you, Meryl Garbus. Thanks again for the conversation. And that brings us to the end of episode 44. Please do subscribe and leave some feedback and reach me with questions, etc. at JennyLSQ. The next episode out in a few weeks features an interview with Tim Heidegger. We talk about music principally, but some comedy as well. And I also have episodes coming up with Empress Of's Lorelei Rodriguez, Dashboard Confessional's Chris Caraba, and King Tuff's Kyle Thomas, among others. Thanks again for listening. Talk to you next time.